In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, there's a passage in regard to the resurrection that makes a statement, and it says that we walk by faith, not by sight. And it is, brethren, a very important concept for us to understand. And yet, when you look at the concept of walking by faith, not by sight, in the day of the apostles, the resurrection was something that was maybe hard indeed to accept. For you and I, having grown up in a culture and an environment where the resurrection and Christ's return, and as we've come into the church, the setting up of His kingdom is something I think that becomes very real to us and very readily accepted. And we have great conviction in that. I don't think believing in the resurrection and in the return of Jesus Christ is where we have our struggles to walk by faith and not by sight. I don't think that's where our battle lies. Our battle in walking by faith, I believe, is much more immediate than that. Now in Hebrews 13 and verse number 5, there is a passage here that is related to the other. It says, "Let your conduct be without covetousness, be content with such things as you have, for He Himself has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear, what can man do to me?" The context here again is that God will always be there, that He will not leave us or forsake us, and that we have that conviction in faith, that we can believe indeed that that is so. But the issue for us becomes an issue that becomes much more day by day, week by week, and as we live our lives. There's a number of examples in the Bible. Sometimes when we have good times, we feel that we're blessed of God. When we have bad times, then it's harder to have faith and harder to trust God and to be reminded that we do not walk by sight, that we walk by faith. In Genesis 37, I'd like to read a few examples there in Joseph's life and how his perspective changed, his circumstances changed. Genesis 37 and verse number 3 says, "Israel loved Joseph," I think I said Jacob, I meant Joseph, "more than all of his children because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a tunic of many colors." And so you might say that Joseph here had kind of a charmed early life, that he was the favorite of his father, and his father gave him very special presents and gifts and treated him with special honor. And yet, the very next verse in 4 says, "When his brothers saw that their father loved him more than them, they hated him and wouldn't speak peaceably to him." So on the one hand, his life was very, very good, and on the other hand, his life wasn't so good at all. That brought discord into his life. Verse 12, "Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, 'Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I'll send you to them.'" And basically said, "Well, here I am, I'll go, fine, I'll do whatever you have asked." He says, "Please go and see indeed that it is well with them." Verse number 23, "So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped him of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, and there was no water in it." In verse 28, "When the Midianite traders passed by, they pulled him up out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt." Here is someone, if you were looking at walking by faith and not by sight, that's what you'd have to do when you're down in the pit, right? If you walk by sight, when you're down in the pit, it looks pretty bleak. If you walk by sight and you're being carried away by the slave traders to Egypt, it looks pretty bleak. When you look at the concept of God saying, "I will never leave you nor forsake you," you cannot walk by sight. Chapter 39, verse number 1, "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there." And it says, "The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand, God miraculously intervened and blessed his works and his efforts, and Joseph found favor in his sight and served him, and then he made him overseer of his house and all that he had put in his hand. So one moment Joseph has it very good, and then one moment he has it very bad, and then even though he's still a slave, another moment he has it very good. He's a master of the house, and so obviously he had good quarters and fine garments and plenty of food and authority and responsibility and a degree of respect that went with it. And then, verse number 7, it came to pass after these things that the master's wife cast longing eyes on him and said, "Lie with me." And verse number 20, it says, "Then Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison after he ran out of the house, and she grabbed his garment and had that as her proof and aspersion against him. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison." What happens if you walk by sight? Well, when you're in the hole, it looks pretty bad. When you're in the prison, it looks pretty bad. When things are going well, it looks pretty good. But if you believe indeed, when God says, "I will never leave you nor forsake you," you have to walk by faith, because that changes so many, many times. Joseph now in prison in verse 21, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison, and whatever they did there was his doing. And the keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him. Whatever he did, the Lord made it to prosper." So, do you find in your life that maybe there are times when you're very, very low, and there are times when you're very, very high? There are times of success and credit and opportunity, and there are times of trial and test and frustration and struggle. And yet God says, "I'll never leave you." And do we look differently at God in those times? Do we look differently at God when we have less access, option, blessing in our own eyes? Or do we indeed strive to walk by faith? In the environment of Joseph being in prison, God put before him both a problem and a solution that he actually created. God gave him a gift of being able to interpret and respond and answer to dreams and to explain them. Now, I don't assume that everybody that has a dream came from God and therefore there's an answer to it. These are dreams that God himself put in there for the questions to be answered, and then gave Joseph the key to unlock those dreams. So he put in place effectively the lock and then handed Joseph the key to unlock them and solve the problem as a solution. Chapter 41. "Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years, I'm not sure, no matter how good you had it, if you had to be there 2 years as the keeper of this prison, if it would be indeed a blessing in your eyes. But it says, Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river." And without going through the actual dream, there were 7 fat cows and 7 lean cows. And the fat cows were good years, and the lean cows were bad years, and the lean cows ate up the good years, and Pharaoh wanted to know what the meaning of the dream was. Excuse me. Because Joseph had this gift of understanding and explaining dreams, verse 14, "Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. And he shaved and changed his clothing and came to Pharaoh." So in the environment that he was in, it wasn't like he was out to dinner every night and in the finest of accommodations. He was living at that level of sustenance in the prison itself. Excuse me. That's what you get for taking a drink, right? Pharaoh sent to him, "Behold my dream. I stood on the bank of the river." And he begins to go through and describe it. And Joseph turns to respond somewhere in this chapter. I think I'll go to Verse 28, this is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh, and God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. And he mentions the 7 years of plenty and the 7 years of famine and the troubles and the trials that were then. And he said, now therefore, verse 33, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. And let Pharaoh do this and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh. And let them keep food in the cities. And then that food shall be as a reserve for the land, for the 7 years of famine which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. So God actually brought Joseph down into restricted circumstances and then raised him back up and blessed him and gave him great opportunity, and yet he had to understand that God would say, I will never leave you nor forsake you. In good times and in the bad, he had to learn to walk by faith. If he walked by sight, he would have become very discouraged and maybe even become embittered and turned aside. Now, the story of Daniel is very similar to that in many ways, and I want to abbreviate quite a bit of that, but I do want to show you some things in Daniel as well. In Daniel 1 and verse 1, it says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with the articles of the house of God, and he carried those away to the house of his God. And down in verse 6 it says, now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. And so, you know, to be carried away into captivity, this is not a very positive thing. It was a great disaster and a trial. And yet, these servants of God, even as young as they were not walking by sight. God was blessing them, and he was able to, even in the midst of that, to raise them back up. In verse 17, as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And the king interviewed them, verse 19, all of these captives that were put forth to serve in the kingdom, and there was none found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, therefore they served before the king. Now, they were exalted, raised back up, and if our lives are not like this, maybe not on scale, but if our lives are not like this, and I think we've all kind of deceived or even ourselves, because God is always there. God was with him in prison. God was with him in prosperity. God was with him in trial and test and in the dungeon. God was with him when they were leading and serving and guiding others. And in God's perspective, nothing changed. Only thing that changed sometimes was theirs and our perspective as well, based on the circumstances that we find ourselves faced with. In the second year, chapter 2 of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. And the king gave command to call the magicians and the astrologers and whoever was a wise man in his land, and they came and stood before the king, and he said, I want you to tell me the meaning of my dream. And they said, well, tell us the dream, and then we'll explain it to you. And he says, no, I want you to do one better than that. I want you to tell me what the dream was and explain it. And he says, and if you don't, I'll see that you're cut in pieces, and your house is made a dung heap as well. His magicians and his astrologers said, there's no way any man can do that. Only the gods, as they looked at the gods in a plural sense, only the gods know what's in a man's heart. And the king was very angry and furious with him, and he gave a command to destroy all the wise men out of Babylon, which included Daniel and his three friends. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. I suppose at that point in time, it would be kind of hard to walk by faith and just imagine that everything was going to be okay. But it says that Daniel went on in indeed wisdom. In verse 24, Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and thus said to him, "Do not destroy them. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation." Daniel says, "I will indeed do as you have requested." Daniel goes through, and in this case, it is the image with the head of gold and the shoulder and the arms of silver and the thighs of brass and the legs, the two legs. And Daniel goes through and explains very favorably to the king, because he said that you are indeed that head of gold. And he explained very favorably. And verse 46, when King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded they should present an offering, an incense to him. And the king answered Daniel and said, "Truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of lords, the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret." And the king promoted Daniel, gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, the chief administrator over the wise men of Babylon. And Daniel petitioned the king and set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, and Daniel sat in the gate of the king. Over and over again, God is always with him. God doesn't change. God is always working things out. But one day, as the song said, he's the windshield, and one day he's the bug. And it never seemed to just stay in one spot. And yet, would that cause him, and should that cause us to doubt God's mercy or care or commitment to us? You go on from here, and you have Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego thrown into the fiery furnace. You have Daniel thrown into the lion's den. You have time and time again, you have test and trial and then demotion and then promotion. And yet God's purpose and plan was always the same. We must, brethren, always be willing to do our part. But we must be living by faith and not by sight. Because when we start tying in our relationship to God based on how the physical sensitivity is around us, what it looks like, how big the clouds are, how tall the barriers are, then that is a destroyer of our faith. And it challenges our faith in God. When Michelle and I lived in Southern California, for many, many years, the spokesman's clubs were a very, very strong element of the church and very highly promoted and participated in the banquets. And I can remember so many speeches and banquets and activities and clubs, but there was a time when clubs died out, just ceased to exist in the churches. And in Southern California, there were probably 4,500 brethren scattered through that region. And at one point in time, there wasn't a single club that remained in the entire area. And some of the men got together there in the auditorium and through Southern California and decided that they would start another spokesman's club and try to fire the system back up and get it going and get people involved and use it as a way to encourage the church as well. And so they started that very first spokesman's club, and I had the opportunity to be president of the club, and officers that were my friends and I served together. And I really liked that. That was kind of a high moment where I could say, "Hey, look what I have opportunity to do. We're starting over. We have a club. I get to lead." You know, it was kind of exciting. The last spokesman's club I was in was the one that prepared me the most, though, for my service in the church ministerially. The last club I was in before we were sent out to the field, they took a friend of mine who had never been a member of club in his life and made him president. And then they made me his vice president and asked me to just kind of help him so that it would work. I wasn't sure exactly what the logic of that was, but he was a good friend, and I thought, fine. On the very first club meeting we had, the director of the club wanted us to give icebreakers. We know an icebreaker is. Anybody can do an icebreaker. You get up, you give a little bit of, you know, blah, blah, blah about your life, and it lasts for a few minutes, and everybody's very polite and claps, and it's probably the easiest thing you'll ever do in this life. And the president went up first, who'd never been in club before, and gave his icebreaker, and the director looked kind of quizzical, and I wasn't sure how this was going. And I got up and gave mine, all the other officers got up and gave theirs, and the director got up and flunked every single one. And I thought, you know, that's amazing. it's like flunking starting your car or something. I mean, that's that was a club I was in before I was getting ready to go out and serve God's people, and it seemed like whatever we tried to do, somehow somebody decided it was wrong. When I left Pasadena, it wasn't because I was promoted, it was because I was fired. I was sent out of Pasadena to kind of a good riddance to bad rubbish kind of a concept. And if you can make it out in the field, then you'll be all right. We'll still use you. But it wasn't a high hand. And then when I went out and we went out into the field ministry, the individual that I was working under didn't want to ordain me. And so we just kind of went on and on and on, and time drags on and nothing really happens. And finally, I just couldn't stand it anymore. And I finally just said, look, are you going to ordain me or not? And he looked at me with his eyes kind of big. He says, I've never had anybody ask that kind of a question. I said, well, would you tell me if indeed I'm serviceable to the ministry, if I'm suitable, if I can be of assistance or not? Because I said, if I can't do this, then I said, I'm willing to go do something else. You know, I don't want to just go on forever and never land here. I'm willing to go do something else. So I suppose out of obligation as much as anything, he ordained me. But I look back at those times as God was preparing us and me for that type of service, and it wasn't a time of success or high hand or great, you know, much of anything. It was a time that we remember together as almost a continual trying and testing, and there was a lot of time when you felt like you were sitting there in the pit looking out, and you really had to stop and focus on walking by faith because it didn't look good. And yet God was giving us opportunity to go out and serve ministerially in His church, which was an incredible opportunity and the finest opportunity we together have ever had. You know, it's important, brethren, that we don't focus too much on our physical circumstance and environment around us. I admire those who graduated in various circumstances today because it showed a commitment and effort to accomplish and produce. And I think we should make those efforts, and we should use this life, and we should use this society in the best way that we possibly can in our service to God. But many times, circumstances are going to turn against us, and they're not going to accomplish the goals that we had hoped and our dreams. And sometimes we're going to see the goals and dreams that we had in this life absolutely evaporate and disappear and simply never totally be fulfilled. Will that shake our faith and encouragement in God's direction and guidance in our lives? Will we still walk by faith? God is described in the Bible in different ways. I want to show you some of the names of God, because His names and how He is referred to describe some of the ways in which we should see Him as well. In Genesis 22, I want to start there, in verse 14. This is the circumstance where Abraham was to offer up Isaac as a sacrifice. And he came to know God in a particular way because of what God then required of him. Genesis 22 and verse 14, after the ram had been given, after Isaac's life had been spared, and after Abraham saw from the end what God's intention really was, he says, Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide." I think in the King James you have Jehovah Jireh. And the YHVH, the Yahweh, the Yahweh, the translation of Jehovah, Lord in capital letters as well, what Mr. Armstrong used to refer to as the Eternal. Abraham came to see God in a formal way. This is a name in reference to God, and the name is "The Lord will provide." And so because God intervened for Abraham in that time of trial in that specific way, then he came to know God as a provider. In Exodus 15, there's a different account. In verse number 26, Here we have the waters of Marah that were bitter and apparently some kind of poisonous, and they needed water to drink, and God intervened and made the waters pure and sweet so that they could drink it. In that sense, He healed the waters. He made them right. And in Exodus 15:26, He says, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in His sight and give ears to His commandments and keep all His statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. Yahweh Rapha, the Lord our healer. Exodus 31 is the covenant that was made where Israel was given the Sabbath for a sign. Exodus 31 and verse 13. We see a God that sets us apart for special and holy purpose and use. Exodus 31, verse 13. Speak also to the children of Israel and say, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Sanctify, set apart for a holy purpose, Yahweh Mekadishchem, and God who sanctifies us and makes us special and gives us purpose. And it comes each time through a particular circumstance where God works with His people in that way, and then God portrays Himself as, I am the God who heals you. I am the God who sanctifies you. I am the God who provides for you. So that through those trial and tests that they would learn the lesson and begin to walk by faith. In the book of Judges, chapter 6, another account here. This one in the calling of Gideon. Gideon was called to protect God's people against the Midianites who were oppressing them, to raise him up as a judge to lead them in battle. Judges 6 and verse number 24. It's interesting when you read about Gideon too, because God calls him and then he responds, and then Gideon has some doubts, and then God has to reassure him, and then he says, how about wetting the fleece? And then God says, all right. And then he says, how about wetting everything else but the fleece? And God says, all right. But he has to walk Gideon through this to get Gideon to trust him. And he takes away the army so that Gideon won't look, we talk about Gideon's army. Every fractured piece of the Church of God calls themselves Gideon's army because that's about what size they are. And we all draw the same analogy and apply it to ourselves, but this is where it comes from. But Judges 6 and verse 24, so Gideon built an altar there to the Lord, and he called it the Lord Shalom, the God of peace, or God sends peace or brings peace. Shalom, peace. God is the one who gives us peace, intervenes for us, helps us. Joe Clark this morning was giving the sermonette in Kennewick, and he talked about some particular times in his life where he suffered trial or test and how he's had to stop and literally walk away from a circumstance for 30 seconds so that he could focus enough to pray, so that he could get his mind back on God, so that he could then go back and face the task at hand. He mentioned this last week. He was working, and he's a pharmacist in Kennewick, and he's in a store that I think has the highest volume of prescriptions filled in the entire Northwest region, and they're just intensely busy there. And some man came up yelling and screaming at his doctors, and therefore they had messed up his prescription. He says, and I'm going to be right here in your face until you get it done. And Joe was just... he said, I reached over first. I grabbed him by his throat. No. But Joe was describing some of these circumstances, how he had to stop and go to God to make enough of a connection so that he could carry on responsibly at that moment in his life. But it says, I am God who gives you peace. You can come to me and I intercede for you miraculously in that way. In Ezekiel 48, another portrayal here of God's intercession for us in a particular way. This is at the very end of the book of Ezekiel, and the last eight chapters give a lot of symbolic portrayal of the temple and such, so I don't need to go through all of that, but at the very last verse of the book of Ezekiel, verse 35, chapter 48, it says, all the way around shall be 18,000 cubits, and the name of the city from that day shall be the Lord is there, because it's talking about God's presence in his people and coming back to be with his people. And so it says, the name shall be the Lord is there, Yahweh Shammah, God is there. Now what's interesting, and I don't know, it may be something you've studied or something that you haven't, but what's the most famous psalm in the Bible? What's the most common psalm in the Bible? 23rd Psalm. And I'd like to show you something in the 23rd Psalm, because we know the 23rd Psalm focuses on God being a shepherd for his people and interceding and intervening for his people in various ways. But when you see that each verse focuses on an attribute of God that he points out somewhere else, you'll just see how compact and meaningful this is. The Lord is my shepherd, God shepherd, Yahweh Roy, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. Yahweh Shalom, peace. God brings peace. He restores my soul. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Restoration, healing, Yahweh Rapha. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Yahweh Shammah, God is there, for you are with me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Yahweh Mekadishkim, God who sanctifies. Each verse focuses on a major attribute of God that is shown through the Bible as one of the ways in which he is referred to or remembered by, or in ways that he especially interceded for his people. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. There are always circumstances in our life that God intercedes for us, and again, sometimes it's when we're standing in the pit or in the dungeon, and other times it's when we indeed do have a high hand and God blesses us. Len and Gloria Judd, who were here for the weekend visiting us, my cousin and wife, and they have a daughter who a number of years ago was run over by a tractor trailer, if you can imagine that. She was on a bicycle on the corner of a city street and getting ready to cross the street, and this truck turned the corner too tight and pulled the rear wheels over the corner, and she kept pulling that bike back and she got tangled up with her foot in the bike, and that truck kept turning the corner and those rear duals actually rolled over part of her leg. And at that time I was talking to Gloria on the phone, and we were all praying and focusing on their daughter and the damage that was done. And over years, there were numerous surgeries and various things had to be. It was quite serious at that time, especially. But one of the things that Gloria said to me, she said, you know, I've spent more time in prayer than I have in years, because she had no choice. That's what happens when you're in the pit. Sometimes we need the pit when we think God is not with us because the truck rolled over our child's leg. And yet in the pit is when he is indeed the closest to us, because God says and illustrates to us in James 4, draw near to me and I will draw near to you. Because there are times in our trial that we are indeed driven to God. It is at those times that we are the closest to him and that he is the most responsive to us. And that's another reason why we must be sensitive to the fact that we do walk in this life by faith. Draw near to God and he will draw near to you. God well may be closer to us in our trials than he is at any other time. When I look at fundamental points in my life and how God worked with me, I find that when God was getting ready to do something significant with me, it was usually because I was failing, not because I was succeeding. It was at a time when something wasn't working instead of at a time when something was. When God got ready to expose me to His truth, I took a job. I got out of the service with a lot of money for me in that day. I had probably $3,200 back in 1972, and it was my cash, and I was single, and that covered a lot of ground back then, and in 30 days I was broke. Oh, it went fast. And I had to take a job, and a job was offered me. It was Len, my cousin, who offered me the job, and it was Gloria who was attending church, and so when I was called into contact with God and His truth, it was because I was broke and I needed that job and I took it, and I wouldn't have done it for any other reason because I didn't want to leave where I was. But it was at a time when I had kind of failed in certain ways, and yet God used that to open up opportunity to me. I think at that point in time I was probably more responsive to Him than I would have been at another. Going to work for the church after I graduated from college was also kind of a circumstance where things had fallen apart rather than when they had all fallen together. I had a career planned, and I had interviewed for a job and was hired, and it was in Texas, and I'd graduated in Pasadena. And I went out to Texas, and there would be 2 weeks until the job began. And so I had 2 weeks to kind of spend, and I thought, well, I'll go back and see some friends in Pasadena and spend a little time, and then I'll return and come back out. And so I went out to Pasadena, and my car fell apart, and I got stuck out there. And I couldn't make it back for the job because the car wasn't running, and I had to now stop and work and go and make the repairs and build back up some cash. And so I had to forego the job, and I went to work temporarily on campus, and I never left. When the car was fixed, there was a different job that was available, and when the cash was back in my pocket, the job was significant enough that I felt the need to stay. But I look at my ability and opportunity to go to work in that capacity, and it came because life fell apart for a moment, not because life had worked so well. Maybe I was more willing to respond to God in that way at that time because of that. The wife that God gave me in service to Him in this church is Michelle. And when I met Michelle, I wasn't even dating. And I had been engaged. An engagement had simply fallen through and simply not had worked. And I was rather distressed at the circumstance. And I was graduated from college and a little bit burnt out, and I just honestly wasn't dating anyone or doing anything. I was working, and I poured my emotions and my time into my job there in the church. And Michelle and I met through a circumstance in a group environment, and we began to build a friendship, and we began to date. But I wasn't looking, I wasn't interested, I wasn't searching. I was healing and resting at the time, and yet when I was down, God then stopped and got my attention and gave me who would be my wife to carry on and serve before Him. Many of the critical junctures of my life were at low spots. There were times when I was more flexible maybe than I would have been otherwise. There were times when God reached down and offered me something better than what I had. Brethren, we have to walk by faith. We must. We must strive to respond to God in that way. The year we were married, Michelle and I went to the feast in Alaska. And one of the things that we wanted to see in Alaska was Mount McKinley. I mean, big mountain, and it was supposed to be glorious and beautiful, and we wanted to see it. And there's a place you can drive up to and see it across an open valley, all in its splendor. And the day that was available, without activities at church there at the feast, we took off in the rain, and we drove partway toward Mount McKinley, and the pouring rain is down, and you can't see very far, and the clouds are real low, and there's no real visibility. And we drove a while, and we said, oh, forget this. And we turned around and went back to the hotel. Perry mentioned Jeff Berg in terms of the leukemia. His father is Will Berg, and you know him maybe ministerially. Will Berg was up there with family at that very same feast, and he was going to go see Mount McKinley as well, and we turned around, and he kept right on going, charging through the fog and charging through the rain, and he didn't care. I mean, he's going to go see Mount McKinley. And he got to the lookout, and he described it, and I felt rather sheepish, but he says, well, we parked the car at the lookout, and the rain stopped, and we kind of prayed that God would give us a chance to see this great, and he's a great outdoorsman. He climbs, and he hikes, and he fishes. I mean, he's an expert in many, many of those things. And he said they stopped in the parking area, and the rain quit, and the clouds lightened up and parted, and then the mountain stood out there, and the sun hit it, and they got all their shots they wanted, and then they got back in the car, and then the clouds came back, and the rain came down, and they drove back to the feast. And he walked by faith, and we walked by sight, and we saw nothing, and he saw what he went to see. It was kind of illuminating that the time to me, and I think to us. We have to see God's hands in our life, even when our life doesn't seem to be working the way that we think it should. Back in Judges 6 again with Gideon, I want to go back and illustrate something here. Judges 6, verse number 11. Sometimes Gideon just couldn't see what God was doing because he looked at the physical circumstances alone. Now here's Gideon. He's hiding from the Midianites to thresh the wheat because he's afraid of them because they'll come in and take it away from him and they won't have their benefit of the harvest. So here's Gideon down here hunkered down. They built the wine press, or the thresher, excuse me, down out of sight. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, hey, big boy. I mean, isn't that what it says? The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor. You know, here's Gideon hiding down here in the thresher, you know, and the angel comes up and says, you mighty man of valor. I mean, he wasn't standing up there with his sword. Gideon was, by all accounts I can see, kind of hunkered down and hiding out, and the angel's giving him a little bit of a tension getter here. And Gideon said, oh, my Lord, if the Lord is with us, then why has all this happened to us? If I'm such a mighty man of valor and God is blessing us, then why do I have to hide to go to work? And where are all these miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt? But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hand of the Midianites. Wasn't exactly walking by faith, and yet God was trying to work with him and bring him up. Then the Lord turned to him and said, go in this might of yours, in all this power that you have and this great confidence, in all this might of yours, and you will save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you? Even though you're hiding, even though you're scared and afraid and doubt, I am with you, and it's going to work. And he said to him, oh, my Lord, how can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh. I am the least in my father's house. And the Lord said to him, surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man. God says, if you would just look to me and trust me, I guarantee you this is going to work. There have been some remarkable circumstances in my life, and I'm sure in yours over the years, where God has intervened in times of desperate circumstance and even doubt. I had a friend of mine years ago who got into trouble with the law and decided that the solution was to run and hide. He was a church member, baptized, and the FBI was looking for him, and he was hiding and chasing around the country, and every so often he'd give me a call, and he wouldn't tell me where he was because he didn't want to have me know something that would get me in trouble, so he'd just check in. And then once in a while, every 6, 7, 8 months, he'd walk in the door in my office and sit down right at my desk, and it'd be like looking at a ghost, and he'd talk and tell me where he'd been and how he'd made it and all these adventures he had, and then he'd head out the door, and again, he'd just disappear into the wilderness, it would seem. And he carried on that role for, oh, I'd say 2 or 3 years. And he told me a story one time toward the end of that period of time where he was hiding among a particular group of people, and somebody recognized or somehow figured out there was a problem and tipped off the police that he was there. And as he was coming back to where his place was, he saw the police car out front and couldn't go back. And he just turned around and he walked right off of that area into open wilderness country on foot with the clothes on his back, no food, no sustenance, no coat, no nothing, the clothes on his back, and he walked out. And that area where he was had a lot of water and some areas that were almost swamp and marshy. And there was a train track that headed out right over the top of this for a number of miles. And he's walking out there that night, as he did. He just, like I said, walked straight out away. He has no spare clothing. And he's on this train track, and on both sides are all water, and it's just the elevated rail that he's walking down the middle of, and he had to go to the bathroom. And this is an incredible thing. The simplest things in life are what trip us up, right? Well, let's see. When I was in school, they called it number two. And he says, you know, he just, life was bad enough. He didn't have any food, no spare clothes. He's running from the police. They're right on his trail. It's dark. It's night. He's out here, and there's a little bit of light from the moon or whatever there was, but he's out at night in this swamp walking on this railroad track, and he just really had to go to the bathroom, and he just couldn't believe it, and he just felt so lonely and so desperate and so empty, and he began to pray to God to help him out, to intervene for him somehow, to work with him there again. And he's walking down these train tracks, water on both sides, and there's a little white spot on the tracks up ahead. And he goes up to it, and he picks it up, and there's a roll of toilet paper. Now, it's the truth. He is my friend. It is the real thing. I don't know how. He didn't know how a roll of toilet paper landed on those tracks out there in the middle of that swamp, in the middle of that wilderness at that moment in time. But he took that as an answer to prayer. He went home. He turned himself in. He plea bargained away some of the charges and made restitution of some of the other issues that were at stake. He was put on probation, and he went on with his life. You know, if you're evading the law, what you're doing is illegal, what you did was illegal, you're hiding and lying because he had to make fake IDs and all of these things to survive and make it from place to place, and all these things that he had done, and yet he was a member of the body of Christ in a very desperate hole and situation, and he cried out to God, and God said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And it would appear that God did something to show him that that was indeed true, and he did. He brought him back. Now, brethren, we have to remember, no matter what our circumstances are, that when God calls us to salvation, he calls us for that great purpose, and he will never turn aside. And it ought to give us faith and strength, even in our simplicity. Sometimes in our foolishness, God still has mercy on us and intervenes on our behalf. The last big activity we had there and spoke in Seattle, for the teens and the activity and the talent showcase and the games the next day. A friend of mine in Seattle walked up and said hello, and we were talking. And I remember a story that he told me years ago when he wanted to go to college. And he wanted to go down and see the campus in Pasadena. And he had just begun to relate to God and kind of wanted to know that this is what God really wanted him to do. And so he prayed to God. He says, if you'll get me a ride to the campus, then I'll know it is your will, and I'll go to college there, and that's what I'll do. And he prayed about that, and then he sat around and kind of waited for someone to bring this ride to him. Now, you know me, I'd go out there, start beating the drums a little bit, or asking, or make an announcement or something, but he didn't do that. He just waited for someone to come offer him a ride. And so after a period of time, somebody came up and offered him a ride. They were headed down to Los Angeles, and did he know anybody that needed a ride down there? He thought about that, and he says, well, college isn't in Los Angeles, it's in Pasadena. He says, I asked for Pasadena. So he said, well, I guess not. You know, no, nobody. He turned it down. Los Angeles wasn't what he had prayed about, and that couldn't possibly be what God had answered him. I mean, God answered Gideon. I'm not suggesting we put God in this kind of a box to get him to respond, but I do know circumstances, and I could list you maybe five, of people in their simplicity that God still honored and worked with in remarkably intimate ways. So he turned down the ride to Los Angeles, and wouldn't you know it, a little bit later, somebody came up and offered him a ride to Ambassador College campus. Did he know anybody that needed a ride to the campus? He says, yes, I do. And he went down, and he went to school, and he stayed. And I just said, it was, I always thought it was strange. I would have never in this life thought to do that or to process something in that way. What God does in terms of intervention for us sometimes is absolutely stunning. One time when Michelle and I were in Nebraska, I had to go out to a wedding rehearsal in the evening, and it was outside of town a number of miles, and it was stormy and snowing that night, and I took off in the van, and the further I went on this road, the worse the snow got, and I wasn't chained, but I figured, well, I keep trying, I better keep moving, you know, and the snow's coming down real heavy. And the snow had come down and blanketed this road completely, and the very edge of the shoulder, there was a little drop off there, an inch or two, and I dropped a wheel over the edge of that asphalt, and in getting back up on the road, I jerked it a little too much, and the van began to slide. Well, you know how it is, you try to reduce the slide each time, a little bit less each time, and bring it back to the middle. But somehow, as you've all probably experienced as well, each time I corrected, it would slide just a little further. And you could tell we're about to lose it, and I'm approaching a bridge, and there's two big abutments on either side, big cement abutments, and I'm coming in about to head broadside into the side of that. And I cried out all by myself, and I just cried out, Father! It was just a spontaneous, I mean, I have no help, and I just says, Father! And the van just went shoop, straight in and right across the bridge. The van absolutely just shot back straight in the middle and lined out, and went right through the bridge and down the road, and there was so much snow there I couldn't even get back that night to get my shaver and clean up for the wedding, which was the next day, and I just had to stay and spend the night. But again, I remember times like that and others when God just said, yeah, okay, I'm here. I'll help. What do you want? What can I do? And he was there, and it was done. Brethren, we have to walk by faith, trust God, put ourselves in his hands, look to him. God has not called any of us to destruction. He works with us day by day for our good. He said that he would never leave us nor forsake us, and he never has, and he never will.